200 years ago this weekend, a Frederick-born lawyer gazed over the water at Fort McHenry as the sun rose during the Battle of Baltimore. Francis Scott Key, by that dawn's early light, wrote a poem that we now know as the Star-Spangled Banner. Beginning today in Baltimore's Inner Harbor, at Fort McHenry, and in the seas and skies around the state, Baltimore's Star-Spangled Spectacular celebrates the 200th anniversary of this iconic song and its important place in our city's history. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Since its publication in 1814, we've learned a lot about the Star-Spangled Banner. And now, for the first time in more than 75 years, there's a new biography of its lyricist. My guest this morning is the author of that biography, Mark Leipson, joins me on the line from WETA in Washington. The book is called What So Proudly We Hailed, Francis Scott Key, A Life. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Tom.
So let's briefly recap for folks a story that has been oft told, particularly around this time of year when we're celebrating this anniversary. What were the circumstances that led to Francis Scott Key being on this ship near Fort McHenry during the battle?
Right. Well, he was a lawyer in Washington. He was 35 years old, and he was a very well-respected lawyer. He was one of the top lawyers in the city, if not the nation. He was great at arguing and great in front of... He had great persuasive power. So he was chosen, he was asked to do a prisoner exchange. After the Battle of Bladensburg, the British had taken, among others, a prisoner named William Beans. He was a surgeon, a medical doctor. Beans was a friend of Key's family, and Key was prevailed upon to go up to Baltimore to help arrange prisoner release of Dr. Beans. Prisoner releases were common during the War of 1812. So he rode up there on his horse. He met John Stuart Skinner, who was in the military, and his job was prisoner release. So Key and Skinner got an American ship, and they found the British fleet, and they negotiated with the British for the release of Dr. Beans.
So there he is. He's on the boat, and he's basically waiting for the battle to be over so that they can all just leave and go back to their regular lives.
Yeah, well, they convinced the British to release Beans, but the British said, you know what, we will let him go. You've convinced us, but you can't go, you can't leave the harbor until after we have just thoroughly thrashed Baltimore. The British were after Baltimore because Baltimore was very, very anti-British, very pro-war hawk. When the War of 1812 started, we didn't have much of a navy, so the call went out for private ships to raid British ships, and guess where more private ships did most damage from any one city, mm-hmm. and that was Baltimore. The Baltimore Clipper, you probably heard of those, the Baltimore Clipper ships. So the British press called Baltimore a nest of thieves, and they wanted to destroy the city. So they said, we will destroy Baltimore. You can't go until we destroy Baltimore. So they put him on another British ship. Then they put him back on the American ship. So that's where Key and Beans and Skinner watched the Battle of Baltimore.
So he's on the ship. He's watching the battle unfold overnight on September 13th into the morning of September 14th. He pulls out an envelope from a letter that he had in his pocket, and he begins writing this poem. And you write in the very beginning of your book, it's somewhat unclear as to whether or not he was writing a poem or a song.
Right.
Do we think that he was writing it to the tune that he would have known, this anacreonic song, bum, ba, bum, 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 bum? Do we think he was thinking of that tune as he wrote the words?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, the balance of historical opinion has changed relatively recently, within the last 2 years, I would say. And by the way, it wasn't an envelope. It was a letter. They didn't even have envelopes back then, right? Remember, the letters folded up.
Right.
And
they were the stand corrected. Yep, you're
that's
right.
Okay. It's a common mistake. So, yeah, I mean, Key was an amateur poet, and I'm sorry to say he was a bad amateur poet, except for what he wrote that night, which, you know, is so far above anything else he ever wrote. It's just, his poetry was never meant to be made public. It was for family and friends, and a group of his poems got published after he died, and you can read them on Google Books. Anybody can read them, and so don't take my word for it. He was a bad poet, and he was unmusical. The family described him as unmusical, which we could take to mean that he was tone deaf, right? He never wrote a song in his life. He was very religious, and he did write what became two Episcopal hymns, but he was not a songwriter. He was a poet. So it was assumed that Key was writing a poem. However, the musicologists who study the early 1800s now have come to the conclusion that, in fact, he had that song in mind. First of all, during that time period, it was very common for people to take words to songs and put them on existing melodies. And the melody To Anacreon in Heaven was a very popular song in the early Republic. They've counted something like 50 songs that were 50 words that were morphed onto that melody to make different songs. So, and of course, it's written in rhyme and meter exactly to correspond with the tune To Anacreon in Heaven. And so, and there's one other piece of evidence, and that is in 1805, there was a banquet given in Georgetown, where Key lived, at a tavern for the Tripolitan war hero, Stephen Decatur. And at that night, Key wrote a poem that was sung that night to the tune of To Anacreon in Heaven, and it had the word star-spangled, not banner, but star-spangled, and he was speaking of the flag. So putting all that together, it's pretty much believed right now that Key had that song in mind that night when he wrote those words.
Mark Leibson is the author of a new biography of Francis Scott Key called What So Proudly We Hailed. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Your book paints a very vivid chronological portrait of this man, Francis Scott Key, Frank Key, as his friends call him, and as you refer to him through most of the book. He had 11 children. He was, as you say, a very religious guy, even, I guess, considered the ministry as a career and then was dissuaded and decided to go into law. Having studied him, what's your general impression of him in his personality, his general nature?
You're right. He was very religious. He considered going to be an Episcopal priest, but, you know, he had a large and growing family, and he didn't think that he could support him. But he was very pious and very active in his church through most of his life. You know, and he was only 35 years old when he wrote The Star-Spangled Banner, or what would become The Star-Spangled Banner. It was originally called The Defense of Fort McHenry, and then later The Star-Spangled Banner. So he was only 35, and he lived to 1843. And he had a very big legal career in Washington, D.C. He was one of the most important players in the early Republic. He was never elected to any office. He wasn't a senator, a congressman, or a governor. He was not an official cabinet post. But he was a very prominent lawyer in Washington. He argued over 100 cases before the Supreme Court. He became a very close advisor to President Andrew Jackson, did a lot of legal work for Jackson, and also served on Jackson's kitchen cabinet, you know, this informal group of advisors that he was very close to. And he was involved in several large and important cases in Washington, D.C. One very quickly was, you know, the first attempted presidential assassination in 1835. A deranged man tried to shoot Andrew Jackson on the steps of Capitol Hill. He fired at point-blank range and missed, and then he fired again with a second pistol. It didn't miss, sorry, it misfired. And then at which point Jackson, who was 64 years old, started wailing the guy with his cane. The man was taken away. He was arraigned by Francis Scott Key, who was the U.S. attorney. He served in that position from 1833 to 1841. And Key quickly realized the man was deranged. He said he was the King of England and all this other stuff. And Jackson, though, saw a political conspiracy and put a lot of pressure on Key to prosecute him, which Key, when he realized the man was insane, he told the jury, you know, if you think this man is insane, you do not have to prosecute him. You do not find him guilty. And in fact, he was found guilty as reason of insanity and spent the rest of his life in a mental institution. So, and that was just one of, a good number of important legal cases Key was involved in.
Key was a slave owner, came from a slave-owning family, yet he also defended slaves as a lawyer. And he was very active in efforts to colonize freed and enslaved blacks back to Africa, in Liberia in particular. There's an interesting dichotomy that you write a lot about in the book between his opposition to abolition, his embracing of the notion of owning slaves, yet he was a lawyer pleading their cases in certain instances, and his solution was this colonization. He was very involved in that, wasn't he?
That's correct. You cannot get away from the issue of slavery with any important player in the early Republic. And in fact, Key was, just as you've laid it out, not only did he defend blacks and free blacks and slaves, but he defended them for free. He had that reputation. And he also was, as you said, a slave owner from a large slave-owning family. But he spoke out against slavery and especially against slave trafficking. Slave trafficking was, international slave trafficking, had been illegal since 1808. although slavery was legal in the United States. And Key's solution was colonization, as you said, and he was a founding member in 1816 of the American Colonization Society, which existed to send free blacks, actually not slaves. They sort of, in their founding constitution, they basically underline and italicize, this is not slaves, this is for free blacks, to a colony in Western Africa that would become the colony and then the nation of Liberia.
Congress had to try about 40 times to pass a bill making this what became the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem. That's certainly very redolent with what's happening these days, you know, with repeated bills about things that never go anywhere. But by the time it was declared the national anthem in 1931, I guess it was common for it to be, you know, used at events and that kind of thing. But
right.
It took that long. Huh?
It took a long time. You're correct. And so, you know, the song became popular soon after he wrote it. But it was only one of other patriotic airs that were played at occasions like 4th of July, the picnic, and so on. Now, during the Civil War, the Star-Spangled Banner became sort of the de facto national anthem of, you know, the Union of the North. And the movement to make it the national anthem slowly picked up steam as we got closer to the turn of the 20th century. And like you said, there was a bunch of bills that introduced. Finally, in 1931, there was a concerted movement led by the VFW and the American Legion, and it resulted in hearings on Capitol Hill. A soprano was called in to sing it, and that sort of did the trick, because the arguments against it are the same arguments that you sometimes hear now. It's very, very difficult to sing, for one thing. If you start out on a high note,
it's a clumsy tune. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, you're a musician. You know that, Tom. And, you know, there are other things about it. They say it celebrates war, it has been said. It's anti-British. And, of course, by the 20th century, the British were among our closest friends. And so those arguments were overcome. And so, really, you know, it's sort of an interesting fact that although he wrote it in 1814, it didn't become the official national anthem until 1931.
Mark Leibson, his new biography of Francis Scott Key is called What So Proudly We Hailed. He'll be speaking at the Enoch Pratt Central Library in Baltimore tomorrow night at 6:30 in the Poe Room. Mark Leibson, thanks for your time and thanks for the book. It's a great read. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
There are dozens and dozens of events celebrating the anniversary of the Star-Spangled Banner this week throughout Baltimore and the state of Maryland. The actor John Lithgow will host a televised event from Pier 6 on Saturday night. It'll feature Smokey Robinson, Denise Graves Montgomery, Kristen Chenoweth, and the Baltimore Symphony, among others. There's also a concert at Fort McHenry that night at the same time, and there are fireworks in both places later in the evening. There's more music at Old St. Paul's Church in Baltimore on Sunday at 5 o'clock. I'll team up with colonial music expert David Hildebrand, the Monumental Brass Quintet, and the Baltimore Choral Arts Society Chamber Chorus for an exploration of the Star-Spangled Banner and other hits of the 1800s. Several ships from all over the world are arriving at the Inner Harbor and Fort McHenry and other places today. They'll be here over the weekend. The Blue Angels are doing flyovers Saturday and Sunday, and Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, at the exact time the flag was raised in the Battle of Baltimore, they'll raise a replica of the 15-star, 15-stripe Star-Spangled Banner flag at Fort McHenry. There's plenty happening in other venues. Come to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, and we'll have a link to complete information. I'm Tom Hall. Sheila will have more on the Battle of Baltimore on the next edition of Maryland Morning, Friday morning, right here on 88.1. Hope you can join us then, and thanks for listening this morning. Have a great day.